I really enjoyed reading Life Size. Once I started, I was mesmerized. I found it. I read it in actually two sittings. I read it yesterday, all except for maybe the last 40 pages, which I finished this morning. And it was mesmerizing. It was so hard to put down. Tell me a little bit about your protagonist in this book and how you came to write it.
My protagonist is a 25-year-old woman who refuses to eat. And when we first meet her, she's been hospitalized against her will because she weighs 67 pounds and is almost starved herself to death. And I chose to write about this character, who's a very extreme character, because I wanted to explore in a very extreme version the kind of anguish and pain and self-hatred that I think many American women experience around issues of body image and weight and food. And so I chose an extreme case as a way of making this visible as a form of anguish.
Now, this malady is called anorexia?
Right, but I never use the word anorexia in the novel. Even though my character suffers from all the symptoms and obsessions and behaviors that would be diagnosed as anorexic, I chose not to use the word because I'm not interested in anorexia as a clinical entity. I'm more interested in the culture that we live in and the forces that convince women that their bodies somehow are unacceptable. And when people ask me what the novel's about, I say it's about how much space a woman feels entitled to take up in the world.
Why do so many women feel that way about their bodies? Obviously, Josie is consumed, obsessed by wanting to feel the bones within her body's structure. There's no answer to that question, is there?
The question, why do women feel that way?
Well, why do some women feel that way?
Well, I think most women feel that way, but not to such an extreme degree. I really believe, and the more I talk to women about this and the more women who read my book, the more I believe it, that most American women really hate their bodies. I think we live in a culture where we're surrounded by idealized images of the female body, images that are really only achievable through plastic surgery, constant exercise, constant self-starvation, and we are somehow convinced that if we don't look like that, we are fundamentally unacceptable, sexually, socially, professionally. And I think that there are many reasons for this, but one is that there's a lot of money to be made out of making women feel inadequate and dissatisfied with their own bodies. The diet industry, cosmetic surgery, fashion are all billion-dollar industries that I think prey on women's vulnerability in this area.
And yet, if you ride the subway, you see plenty of overweight women.
Well, that's the bind, because women are starving themselves all the time, and when you starve the body, it fights back. And that's why women get into cycles of compulsive eating and overeating. And I think that in a paradoxical way, this trying to achieve a starved or thin body makes many women much fatter than they otherwise would be.
Josephine resists all efforts to treat her, doesn't she?
Well, she doesn't think there's anything wrong with her. She thinks she's beautiful, or getting there anyway. And the people who surround her think she's sick and in danger of dying, but she sees herself as somebody who's extremely disciplined and pure and almost approaching a kind of perfection. So she doesn't think she needs help at all, which is very typical of women who have reached a clinical degree of anorexia.
But her obsession with not eating, and then on other periods where she goes on food binges,
mm-hmm.
And she's an intelligent mm-hmm. young woman, she would obviously see that there is something not quite right there.
Well, this was my challenge as a novelist, to show that this character is trapped in this obsession and trapped in a downward spiral that she can't escape from in one way, but on the other hand, that, as you say, she is intelligent, she has a great deal of insight and a great deal of irony and almost humor about her predicament. And what was challenging to me was to show those two parts of herself struggling against each other, the part that can see that she's killing herself and the part of her that's trapped in the obsession and can't think her way out of it.
Josephine also seems disaffected from other people. I think you point out that she really only had two friends,
yeah.
Jane and Jane. And her sexual relationships, her relationships with men, they seem so dispassionate, as though the men, well, she'll have sex with the men, it's almost as though she doesn't care.
Right. I think this is very typical of women who become obsessed with their bodies and with starving themselves, is that they do become emotionally disconnected, or for some women, perhaps the emphasis on their bodies is a result of feeling emotionally disconnected or sexually disconnected. And I think for my character, other people become increasingly unreal. It's as if they don't really have any identity. And one of the ways that I try to show that perhaps there's some hope for her is in the course of the novel, she does establish one very small human connection with the nurse who's taking care of her. And that seems to be a sign of hope.
So you kind of leave us up in the air. We don't know exactly what's going to happen to Josie, do we?
Well, I want you to make up your own mind, because it's not easy. You know, this isn't something that you can cure yourself of overnight, either in your mind or in your body. And many women struggle with it for all of their lives to one degree or another. And I wanted to suggest the possibility of some hope, but not that it's an easy way out.
Well, I don't think the novelist has to reach every conclusion in the world, and it's also important, I think, for the novelist, in a way, to make the reader think and to work, as opposed to, say, some mainstream detective thrillers, mystery stories, where everything is laid out. A sentence will read something like, I hate you, he said breathlessly. You know? He says everything in one sentence instead of unraveling in a gradual way, so that it's like Joan Didion. I think it was called, well, I can't remember the name of it. It was a wonderful novel, very short novel, that was non-chronological. And as you read, it jumped back and forth, and at first I was confused, but by the end of the novel, everything fit, as though I had read it chronologically, but that's not the way she wrote it.
Yeah, and I think that's so much more interesting for the reader, because the reader goes through some kind of process of discovery. It's not all presented to you on a platter. You, in a sense, are a co-creator of the work with your own imagination. And that's one of the things that I was hoping to achieve here, because the novel is not told in chronological order. We gradually discover different parts of her life and different experiences, and the novelist never steps in to make sense of it and put it all back into order and make some kind of sequence of cause and effect out of it. And it's like our own lives. We don't know exactly how they all add up or what they add up to, and we're still in the middle of them. It's not over yet. And that's how I saw my character and her relationship to her memories and her experiences.
I notice you have a significant number of acknowledgments in the back. You've obviously done quite a bit of research into this problem.
I really had to do an enormous amount of research, because it's not autobiographical in the sense that I've never been clinically anorexic, I've never been hospitalized. I mean, it is autobiographical in the sense that I've also struggled with issues of body image. But for the inner experience of somebody who is starving and who is trapped in this obsession, I read a number of first-person accounts, non-fictional accounts by women who'd been anorexic. I read everything I could find that's written about it from a clinical or theoretical point of view. I read medical textbooks, hospital protocols, and I tried to put it all together in an imaginative way to recreate the inner life of a certain person having this experience.
Why don't men seem to have problems to the extent that women do?
Well, this is something that I've learned since the book has come out that I was wrong about, because I used to think, well, men don't have this problem. You know, they have other problems with their bodies. Maybe they wish their biceps were bigger or something. But since I've been talking to people about the novel, I've had to change my mind about that a little bit, because many men have said to me that they do struggle with serious problems with body image. And the latest statistics now are that there are 8 million people in this country a year who are anorexic, and 1 million of those are men. And this is a very recent development. Before, it was almost unheard of for men to be anorexic. So it seems to be increasingly a problem for men, too.
Well, speaking for myself, I'm talking about body image problems. I certainly, when I reach my middle age period, I began to develop a tummy. And this past summer, I developed what the doctor called gastritis, which in my stomach was always inflamed, and I found it difficult to eat without a violent reaction. He put me on a bland diet, and by this time, none of my clothes fit. I was wearing them, but very uncomfortably. And so when he put me on this bland diet, I thought, you know, this is a good way to diet anyway, you know, not just for the gastritis, but to really, and I got rid of about 20 pounds. And I really, and now my clothes don't fit. That's the other way. I need to take
these pants. You're not getting carried away, are you?
What's that?
You're not getting carried away, are you?
It's easy to do. I remember a few years ago, I had gone to Cape Cod to visit some friends I hadn't seen for a couple of years, and I had gone on almost a binge diet. And when they saw me, they said, "Don, are you sick?" I thought I had cancer, because it looked like, and I realized that my face had gotten very gaunt, and that I really had gone a little too far.
But, you know, I think the difference is if you were a woman and you had done that, people would say, "Oh, you look great. What happened? Did you lose weight?" Because I think no one will ever say to a woman, "You really look too thin," until she's almost clinically anorexic, because the images that we see in the media are of women who are really abnormally lean. You know, they represent maybe about 2% of the female population. So it's very rare for someone to say to a woman, "God, you really do look too thin." Usually they'll say, "Oh, you look great. How did you do it? How could I do it?" And I think another reason that it's much more prevalent in women is that women are defined primarily by their appearance still in this culture, are judged more by their appearance than men are. Whereas I think if men are competent and powerful and successful in the world, it's not so important what they look like. Whereas women, I think, primarily still are judged by their appearance rather than their competence or their performance or their other qualities.
At first blush, perhaps.
Yes. But I do think also there's an unwritten rule about appearance in the professional world, too. A woman who weighs 300 pounds is going to be discriminated against on the job market, wouldn't you think?
But I think a man
is
300 pounds.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, yeah.
Because you're talking about a freak.
Yeah,
in effect,
and
a person who seems to be out of control.
Yeah, that's true. But I think a woman who's overweight is perceived as being out of control more than a man who's somewhat overweight.
Well, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's just that some men don't seem to care very
much. Right, that's true.
But did I read somewhere in the publicity material you had an anorexia problem many years ago?
Borderline.
What does that mean?
Well, it means when I was about 16 or 17, I decided that I needed to lose some weight, which is, you know, very common. And being a sort of compulsive, perfectionistic person, I got a little carried away. And I think I was right on the edge there of being clinically anorexic for a couple of years. I never had treatment for it, and I never got frighteningly thin. But when I look back on it, I was living like an anorexic, and my behavior and my obsession was certainly in that realm. And although I didn't take it as far as my character did, and eventually I sort of, if you'll excuse the pun, grew out of it because there were other things in my life that were more important to me, I did have that experience, and I have never really been able to understand it or reconcile it with the rest of my life until I wrote the novel and really explored it as fully as I could.
Now, you grew up in South Africa.
That's right, yes.
What was that like?
Well, what's interesting about growing up in South Africa relative to the novel is that to grow up as a white South African is really to grow up in a culture that's in denial. White South Africans have to live in a constant state of denial, otherwise they couldn't sleep at night. So you have a whole culture that's in denial, not really acknowledging the reality of what surrounds it and of the other people who live there and of the conditions of their lives. And in the same way, my character is in a state of constant denial. And so I think that that is a connection that I wasn't aware of until the novel was finished. But I left South Africa because I didn't want to live there and I didn't want to be implicated in the apartheid system. And now I've gone back for a visit because things are changing there.
Your family's still
there? My family's been there all the time, yes.
When did you come to the United States?
In 1978, and I've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. What did your family do? Was it a literary household?
No, nope, not at all. Neither of my parents have a college education. But we read a lot because there was no television. There was no television in South Africa until 1976. A whole culture without television. People don't believe it when I tell them, but it's true. So I grew up without television. And
well, so did I.
Oh, you did. But then what was
television
the reason?
Television came after my time. I grew up with radio.
Yeah.
I grew up with books.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I just
my
read
my father was the last man on the block to buy a television set. By that time, I was in college.
Yeah.
He was waiting for color.
Did you ever develop a habit?
No,
no, because I, you know,
I don't have a television.
I don't either, because I think if you don't develop the habit when you're growing up, you never do. And when I grew up, reading was my television. You know, I just read all the time. And so I think that's where the literary background comes from, reading so much as a child.
How did you become aware as a young woman in South Africa about the racial problems that the country had?
Well, part of it was just adolescent rebellion, reacting against my parents and everything that they stood for, because they're very conservative, white South Africans. But part of it was also, ironically, because my parents tried to give me the best education possible, and that helped to give me the tools to understand what was going on. And it wasn't really until I went to the university, I went to the University of Cape Town, that I began to really understand it intellectually and see it with my own eyes and try to do something about it.
When did you first start writing?
Well, I've written all my life, but not fiction. I've written essays and criticism, and I used to write poetry, but, you know, who didn't in my adolescence? But I always wanted to write fiction. But I didn't actually start until my early 30s, my late 20s, my early 30s. And it was really a turning point in my life, because until then I'd been an academic. I did a PhD in literature. I taught literature, and I wrote criticism. And then at some point I just decided I didn't want to do that anymore, and I decided to write fiction instead. So I sat down and started writing life-size.
But you're still an academic.
I am, but I don't write conventional literary criticism. I write fiction and I write essays, but I don't think of myself as an academic. I think of myself as a writer who teaches literature.
Mm-hmm. Well, that pays the freight, I guess.
Yeah.
That pays,
for
the habit.
And I enjoy teaching. I find it, I learn a lot from it.
What is your expertise in literature?
Modern novel and international fiction.
Who are some of the modern novelists that you are teaching?
Well, at the moment, I'm very much interested in the new breed of young British writers, like Martin Amis and Julian Barnes. I think they're wonderful.
They are. I've interviewed both of them.
Oh, you're so lucky. I'd love to meet either of them.
Martin, I've interviewed about three times.
I think he's astounding, and I think he just gets better and better. And so I'm very interested in them. And Jeanette Winterston, too.
I don't know her.
She's a young English writer who's interesting. And in terms of American writers, I'm very impressed by Margaret Atwood. I think she's wonderful.
Canadian.
Yes, Canadian, sorry. And there's a South African novelist called J.M. Coetzee, who has a couple of novels, Waiting for the Barbarians and The Light and Times of Michael Kay, which I teach because I think they're brilliant. And I wrote my dissertation on Nabokov, because he's one of my great influences.
I guess you read that stunning two-part biography.
Yeah.
I can't remember the author. I had him in.
Was it Brian Boyd?
Brian Boyd, that's right. From New Zealand.
Yeah,
from New Zealand,
yeah,
So I read, just recently I read both volumes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, when you teach, you're teaching at Emerson, right?
Right.
When you teach, do you have carte blanche as to whom you teach?
Pretty much. You know, the course is defined in a certain way, international women writers or modern British novel. But within that, I have pretty much carte blanche, but I have a sense of responsibility to be representative historically and in terms of genre and approach. But otherwise, yeah.
So what happens at the beginning of the semester? You hand out a reading list?
Yeah, yeah. And I try to work chronologically. And it changes all the time.
Well, then what happens? I mean, when you pass out a reading list,
yeah,
and the class returns, do you have classroom discussions,
yes,
about it?
Yes,
yes. How do you test on something like that?
Well, I never lecture. I don't know how to. I would die of boredom if I had to stand up there and listen to myself pontificate. So, and how can you lecture about a novel? I mean, what I'm interested in is knowing what other people think about it. So it's all discussion. And the way that I test is by having people write a response to the novel of some kind.
Well, I was reading, we mentioned Nabokov. Nabokov taught at Cornell, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would test his students.
Yes.
Literally compel them to describe wallpaper patterns.
Oh, and the layout of a sleeping car, on a railway train, which is the complete opposite approach, because he believed that the only thing that was important in literature were the details, that that's what made literature either great or not great, was the way that the details worked. And so he thought, he didn't care about general ideas, big themes, big issues. He cared only about the language and the details, and that's what he tried to enforce on his students, that they should pay attention to that. And I believe in that too, but I'm also interested in ideas and political ideas and cultural issues.
Yeah, I believe Nabokov thought there should never be a wasted word
in
a piece of fiction.
I believe that too. Yeah. It's easier to talk about than to achieve as a writer. But
I hate to be in his class. I hate to be grilled on something like that.
I hate to have to write anything for him, because I honestly think nobody has written such beautiful American prose as Nabokov, and he wasn't even born in this country. But I agree with that. I don't think there should be a wasted word. And in my novel, because the character is so minimalist in her thinking and in her life and in her body, the challenge for me was to make the novel almost minimalist and skeletal, but also to pack into it all the richness and complexity of her predicament.
Yeah, I think that in many instances some novelists write too much. There's just too much there. And also there's a tendency for novels, as a novelist becomes bolder, to become too big. I don't have room. I had to rent a storage room.
Yeah.
Anyway, a lot of my books.
You mean physically big or
physically
overblown?
Physically big and overblown. James Dickey's last, Al Alam, his last novel, he'd been working on it for years. It's like that thick, you know, and the novel didn't even work. I don't know if you read it. You know,
no, I haven't read it.
He summarizes it as about a blind man in airplanes. And so on one half of it was divided into columns. On one half, it would be what the blind man perceived, and on the other side, not on the other side of the page, but on the
The facing page.
Not on the facing page, but on the same page,
oh,
the other column.
Yeah.
And that would be what actually happened.
Oh God.
Now it was certainly an exercise in intellectual experimentation.
Yeah.
But not wholly successful, and it didn't sell well.
And it must have been a huge strain to read, because
it's hard. You had to go back and forth, and it didn't always even out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, whereas his novel Deliverance,
yes,
was about this size.
Yeah, yeah.
And he packed it the way you did, with great detail, but not a great deal of wordiness.
Well, one of the few things that my character says that I actually agree with, although she takes it too far, she takes everything too far, she says something like, perfection is achieved when there's nothing left to take away, not when there's nothing left to add. And that's how I think of writing, as constantly taking away and boiling things down and distilling things. I start with much more, and I work towards less and less and less. But not less and less and less in the American minimalist sense, the so-called shopping mall fiction, where less and less and less really is less and less and less and becomes just a list of brand names or place names. to me, it's a process of distillation, and it takes time. That's why it took me 3 years to write this very short novel.
You mentioned Liszt. Did you read The Tree of Night by Hugh Nicholson?
No, no.
Wonderful book. It's set in Ohio in the 1800s. One of the main characters is Johnny Appleseed. And it essentially is a book of Liszt. The protagonist would keep a list of things that he would do every day.
Oh.
And in a matter-of-fact way.
Yeah.
And it might say, he masturbated every day, so he had a little phrase for that. I can't remember what it was, but he would say, so-and-so died today. Arrow in the head. And made home brew. Neighbors came from 30 miles to party. By the time you finished the book, there was a whole story there about Indian fights, and people who died, the struggle of living in the wilderness. But it was essentially a book of lists.
But didn't it become monotonous, or did it become fascinating because it was cumulative?
You saw his world. Saw his world and everything that happened in it.
Yeah. No, well, I don't think there's enough experimentation with form in the American novel at the moment. I think people are too timid and too logical and consecutive, as you said earlier, always spelling everything out, tying up all the loose ends, laying everything out on a platter. And I think it's time for more of a playful and experimental approach to fiction. We've become too kind of serious and dull about it, I think. Obviously, I'm generalizing in a big way, but I'm talking about mainstream fiction.
What was it like when you came to the United States? A culture shock?
Well, it's so strange because I expected major culture shock, but coming straight from Johannesburg to Los Angeles, which is where I ended up, I didn't feel that much culture shock. You know, the climate was very much the same as a big, ugly city, diverse population. And the culture shock really only hit me 2 years later when I realized that I thought I was living in a similar culture, but in fact everything was really different and I just hadn't realized it. So it was a different kind of culture shock because it's like the language. You think American English and English English are the same language, but the more you understand about each, the more different you realize that they are. But the worst culture shock I had was when I moved to the East Coast, and I was 27 years old, and I'd never seen snow, and I'd never had a winter in my whole life. And I honestly thought I was going to die. I mean, I literally didn't think I would survive. I walked around crying the whole winter. I honestly didn't know how anyone could ever live through it. So that was the biggest shock of all.
Because you went to Los Angeles to go to school.
Right,
so
I went.
Kind of a nurturing environment.
Yes, it's a mini environment. You know, you have a built-in community there. So that kind of cushioned it as well. And grad school is a world of its own. You know, it's a way of life. Wherever you are, there's a whole world that goes with being in grad school.
But it must be kind of scary going to a distant place. Did you have friends here at all?
No, I didn't know one person on the whole continent. No, I was young. I was reckless. All I ever wanted to do in life was leave South Africa, and I thought it was a huge adventure. I could never do it now, you know. I don't know.
I'm sure you could.
Well, maybe I could, but then it just seemed like a big adventure, and I was sure everything would be fine, and there was this whole world out there, and I just couldn't wait to explore it.
Your remark about the snow is interesting. I had grown up in Ohio, and then my family, my father was an oil man, and they moved to Houston, Texas. So I think I was in the second grade or third grade in Houston. One afternoon it began to snow. Now, they don't have snow there.
No.
And they closed the school. Kids ran out. They had never seen snow. I had seen it.
Yeah.
These little kids out there trying to grab it. Hopefully.
Oh.
Sticking their tongues out with the snow. Uh-huh. And naturally, of course, it would hit the ground.
Yeah, and melt.
Vanish.
Yeah.
But to actually see snow, they had never
seen
it.
Yeah, no. And you don't realize how much the climate affects your mental state. You know, you just take things for granted until they're different, and then you realize it really has to do a lot with your moods and your body and how you feel about things.
What's Boston like for you?
Well, I've grown to like it. It took me a while, but I like it because, you know, it has most of the advantages of a big city and not all of the disadvantages. So I'm happy there for the moment anyway.
Cold.
Yes, but I've adjusted now. I know I'll survive through the winter.
I drove up to Boston to visit a friend with whom I'd worked here for a number of years. And New York was warm.
Yeah.
And so I had a London fog. I didn't even bring gloves or a scarf or anything. And I'm driving up through, I think I stopped at, it's called Old Stourbridge. And I stopped there. And we got out of the car. I was going to stay overnight there on the way up to Boston. And it was bitter cold. Bitter cold. And I thought, gosh, if I have a flat tire and have to go out and try to change it without gloves.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe how the climate could change so radically over, what is it, 200 miles, 300 miles?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it because New York was actually warm.
Yeah, no, it's a very unforgiving climate there. And I think one of the things that I keep forgetting is that I am a stranger to this culture. You know, I've lived here so long that I almost feel like an American. And yet there are always things that happen to me that remind me that I'm not. And I think maybe that perspective helped me to write the novel in the sense that I don't take anything for granted. You know, I'm always trying to read the culture and interpret the culture because it isn't completely natural to me yet.
Are you planning to become an American citizen?
I'm a permanent resident.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I'm a British citizen because my father's English.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'll leave it that way for the time being.
So what are your future plans?
Well, I'm starting a second novel, which has nothing to do with food or body or weight. And I'm planning to plug away at that and hope it doesn't take me 3 years this time as well.
Well, you've got plenty of years ahead of you to write. Life Size is certainly a beautifully done book, Jennifer Shute. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.